from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For years, Iraqi scholar Kanan Makiya made the overthrow of Saddam Hussein his mission in life. He wrote passionately about that most brutal of regimes long before most Americans even knew who Saddam was. When the neocons took sway in Washington, he assured them Iraq was yearning for democracy, ready for peace and prosperity, and that even if we couldn't be sure it was worth the shot, the experiment, as he's called the Iraq War. Today, with so much of Iraq in bloody chaos, he turns over in his head and heart what went wrong and where he went wrong. This hour on Point, Kanan Makiya on morality, reality, and what has happened in Iraq. You can join the conversation. Was Kanan Makiya right to push for Saddam's toppling, for the U.S. to do it? Was he naive? And what do you make now of Kanan Makiya's public regret? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio today is Kanan Makiya. Over the years, he was probably the most prominent and passionate voice in the world on the cruelty of Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime. He wrote 5 books on the subject, most famous being Republic of Fear. He pushed for years for Saddam's ouster. He is now a professor of Islamic and Middle Eastern studies at Brandeis University. He was profiled in the New York Times Magazine last Sunday in an article titled Regrets Only. Kanan Makiya, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for inviting me.
There's so much to talk about here. Begin just in your own words to take us into where you stand in your mental process, your moral reckoning, your look at past and present when it comes to this conflagration in Iraq.
Well, Tom, let me begin with your introduction. I am rethinking many of my former assumptions, but the one thing I am not rethinking is the decision to rid the world of the Saddam Hussein regime. Let me explain what I mean. The bulk of all my books and all my writing was to describe the nature of that regime. And if you follow my argument, if you buy the case I put forward over many books, a description of that regime, you realize Iraq was 25 million people living in a giant concentration camp, Auschwitz-like concentration camp. Now, the American army decided at the end of World War II to liberate the concentration camps, which had 20, 30, 50,000 Jews in them, etc., in different places. To me, the moral question, do you or do you not break open the walls of that concentration camp and get rid of the guards, is a non-starter, is a no-brainer. Of course you do.
Who's the you?
I mean, in this case, the United States. I'm using the analogy of the United States for a second. That the United States Army goes in to various other people who have nothing to do, who are not American. They're sitting in this concentration camp, Jews in this case. And do you...
You're talking
or do you,
World War II, going
I'm
all the
talking
way back
World to, War II, but
drawing
I'm drawing
that analogy.
I'm drawing an analogy. Mm-hmm. So the issue of whether or not you get rid of the administration of those concentration camps is, for me, still to this day, a no-brainer. Of course you do, morally speaking. Now, in the case of Iraq, you're dealing with 35 years of abuse of 25 million people. Do we know or can we predict with any kind of accuracy how these people will react? What kind of a society? Do they even know who they are? What kind of a society they want to build? What democracy means? And all these other huge big questions. Well, here the activist in me, which is separate from the writer in me. The writer in me only ever described that concentration camp. The activist in me wanted something new, wanted a new beginning for those 25 million people inside that concentration camp. And that, I also have no regrets. But what happened, my activism and that of many other people, did not result in the outcomes that we had hoped for. And herein lies the big questions. It's not that the 25 million people did not greet the United States Army with sweets and flowers, as I put it to President Bush and as I am so often criticized for. It is that why did they greet them with...
2003
in the Oval Office. The question is, why was that greeting so short-lived? Now, that is an interesting and important political question. What went wrong? What went wrong in that very concrete sense? But what went wrong in the sense that I think you meant it, or I hope you didn't mean it, but many people do pose the question that way, meaning why should we ever have gone there in the first place? That's an entirely different question about which I have not changed my mind one iota.
If I recall correctly, there was a point at which you said, there may only be a 5% chance of this turning out as we hope, but it's still worth it.
Yes.
Were you not playing fast and loose with that perspective, with the lives of young American men and women, a 5% chance, and it's still worth it? Who are you to say that?
Now, I'm not playing fast. I'm not a decision maker. I'm not the president. I'm not even a vice. I'm nobody.
An advocate cannot walk away from opinions.
No, but wait.
You advocate.
Yes, I advocate. I call for. I can argue for. But I am not a decision maker. Now, wait a minute. And I didn't say the 5% lives of Americans. All I said was I personally would opt to work for that new beginning, even if I knew that new beginning had only a 5% chance of success. And that is, by the way, the nature of being political. What does it mean? What is politics? It is an activity that we human beings do in concert with one another. It is the making always of new things. If I were to sit down and say, I think the 25 million people who've lived through 35 years of abuse are so traumatized, are so destroyed, that I better not even go in there because the kind of psychological and social problems that are going to erupt if I even go in there in the first place, which I can calculate and I can look back on other experiences, are so enormous. I'm not going to get myself into this mess. That's not politics. That's crass, cool, cold calculation. Politics is about new beginnings. And I believe in trying to make a new beginning. And there are new beginnings in Iraq. The issue is, the issue is having opted to be an activist, having opted to be political and go for new beginnings in Iraq, why did things go in the direction that they've gone?
We'll look at that. Let me ask you, Dexter Filkins wrote the big piece in the Times last weekend. He opens it at a guest house in the mountains of Kurdistan, a dinner hosted by Iraq's president, Jalal Talabani. And there people are sitting at dinner, you know, Barham Saleh saying, you know, we had to do this. Fawad Ajami, Johns Hopkins professor, we had to do this. Dexter has you asking the question to your colleagues there, your comrades. Well, okay, but how many Iraqis have died since 2003?
This is
not the Saddam era. This is after Saddam. I asked about the death of American soldiers. What about the death of Iraqis since that time? How does that weigh on you now?
It weighs very heavily, but it weighs in the following sense. Who do I hold overwhelmingly responsible for the death of those Iraqis? Not Americans. I hold the Iraqi leadership, the new political class that came to power in Iraq post-2003, primarily responsible because of the bad choices it made, again, post-liberation, because after all, it did not liberate itself. This is a very important point. Maybe one can have a very interesting discussion whether anybody can be liberated by somebody else and make a good job out of the final enclave. I think that's a very real and important question.
Maybe we should have had that
in 2002, in 2003, January, before
March.
That is entirely possible. That is, it may very well be that you need to be involved and pay the pain and the price of liberating yourself from a terrible totalitarian regime like that of Saddam Hussein.
Or don't be liberated.
In order to work your way through. But I still can't make that. I still don't say that. I say that there come times in the lives of men, in the lives of human beings, in the lives of nations, when they need help from outside. And that the world, that our nature as human beings is for me the fundamental fact, not our national differences, not our being broken up into an American nation state, an Iraqi nation state, et cetera, et cetera. Our humanness, the oneness of our species counts it for me in everything I have done in my life and comes first. And the oneness of our species said that if there was a great country out there like the United States willing to do what all those other countries would not do, including Europe, for the sake of, for whatever reasons it did it. By the way, we can come to that. That's a whole separate thing. I wish that it had done it for the best of all possible reasons. Now, we know, you and I, that it did
not
do it.
We'll talk about it.
We'll talk about that. But if it had, for whatever reason, that it does what is morally the right thing to do, in spite of the enormous risks, here's the 5% coming in spite of the enormous risks involved, I still think that is infinitely superior to somebody who sits back and watch those 25 million people rot.
But the foreign policy realists, the realist camp, always said, do not do this. You told Dexter Filkins of the Times, you said to him, what do you mean by this? You said to him, you know, in a way, the realists are right. They are always right, even when they are morally wrong.
Exactly.
That seems to contradict what you just said.
No, it doesn't. It goes back to that 5%. The realists are always right in that you sit back and you watch 25, if you can, in your heart of hearts, you, Tom Ashbrook, sit back there and let 25 million people rot under Saddam Hussein's regime, knowing as you do in your heart, in your bones, so to speak, the pain that that regime has caused and is causing and the damage it's doing through the whole region. That is something you have to live with.
But what about this catastrophe now?
You have a chance.
For Iraq, for the region, for America's standing in the planet.
It's enormous. It's enormous. I don't for one second wish to diminish that. But the question we're now
discussing... Don't they have to be weighed by a moralist or a realist?
But can they be calculated is the interesting question.
Don't you have to try?
But can they be, in principle? Can you have a revolution? Can you overthrow a dictatorship and calculate the results and know in advance, according to some sort of theory of social... This is not social science we're dealing with. This is the world of politics, the world of human beings, of human behavior, actions in concert. Can you predict that? The very nature of that is it's unknowable. The very beauty of it is that it's unknowable. An election is a perfect example. Can you ever really know the result in spite of the best polls in the world? You can make a very good guess. You can hope it'll go one way or the other. Your heart can be with one candidate and not the other candidate. But can you ever know how an election will go? And the beauty of it is
or
that you
war.
Cannot. Or a war.
And I don't know if it's beautiful or not. We'll come back and look at it. Kanan Makia is with us. He was a passionate critic of Saddam Hussein, pushed for his toppling. We see where we are now. He's adding it all up. So are we. 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with high-profile Iraqi scholar and super advocate of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Kanan Makia, about how he looks now at his early passion for this war, about what he's learned from what's gone wrong, what's gone on, in Iraq. You can join the conversation at 800-423-8255. What do you think? Was Kanan Makia right to push for Saddam's toppling and for the U.S. to do it? Was he naive? Was he reckless? Was he foolish? And was our road, to some say hell, in Iraq paved by the good intentions of people looking at the world like Kanan Makia? Or is he right that if there is a oneness of our species, we had no choice here, but to ask. We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. In the autumn before the U.S. invasion, Kanan Makia was a guest on NPR's All Things Considered. The host, Robert Siegel, asked him how long U.S. troops would have to stay on after an invasion to help stabilize his country.
I just have one other question about the future, and that is 3 years down the road, 5 years down the road, where are the Americans in all this? Where are the U.S. forces that... that made war against Saddam Hussein's army and defeated him?
Well, I see them as dwindling in numbers as the situation stabilizes and as the army is reformed and the law and order services are reformed, and dwindling to the point of them no longer being necessary. By about around 4 or 5 years, hopefully, the threats to Iraq that might emanate from some of the surrounding countries would no longer be real. Iraq's ability to deal with them would have been established, and that presence would no longer be needed. Never do we in this report envisage any American troops policing the cities of Iraq. That's an important point to add.
No American troops policing the cities of Iraq, Kanan Makia imagined in 2002. Looking forward there at Robert Siegel's questions, at 3 or 5 years down the road, we're nearly 6 years down the road now, Americans all over the streets of Baghdad.
I didn't imagine American troops. Not. I recommended strongly to President Bush personally and in a whole series of written documents that I wrote for the Iraqi opposition that American troops not police the streets of Baghdad. That's an entirely different thing. I did not want them policing the streets of Baghdad way before the war broke out. That's different.
So is that like Donald Rumsfeld? You know, stuff happened in Baghdad. They shouldn't be policing there. Who should have kept it from falling apart?
We're discussing whether or not I wanted American troops policing Iraqi cities. I disagreed with the entire strategy that was actually followed by the administration. This is important for the record. Mm-hmm. I was against the idea of an American occupation of Iraq. Actually, every Iraqi in exile or in opposition groups, Kurds, Arabs, Shiites, Sunnites, who were part of the opposition to the regime of Saddam Hussein opposed the idea of occupation.
Okay, let's hear it your way then. What should have happened compared to what did happen,
please? There should have been a transitional government that stabilized and that made law and order its primary purpose immediately afterwards, and that was created by a joint partnership with the United States. It would have been looked at by the rest of the world as a puppet government, to be sure, but that government would have been temporary. It would have been there only until the first general election.
But who would have staffed it? Who would have been those police? Who would have been those soldiers?
Many Iraqis. You know, hundreds of Iraqis had been working, thousands even over the years, with the United States government in one form or another. It could have been created and constructed with American help beforehand. It should definitely have included the Kurds. Don't forget, 25% of the territory of the country was already being run by Iraqis, i.e. Iraqi Kurds, that the Iraqi Kurds had hosted the opposition. That was the place where it should have
been. Where were those people? Was the United States blocking them from coming in and bringing order to the streets of Baghdad?
There was a war inside your administration, inside the American administration, over this issue. And those who were against the creation of a temporary transitional government, largely from the CIA and the State Department, won that war of ideas. There was a serious battle.
I just don't recall seeing those masses of Iraqi Democrats ready to police the streets of Iraq, ready to bring order to that chaotic scene.
How could you see Democrats in a country that's a totalitarian system? They were largely outside.
So you're going to bring in people who were, I don't know, out of the coffee shops of London are going to show up?
There was a Kurdish administration that ran 25% of the territory of Iraq.
Are they going to police the streets of Baghdad, ethnic Kurds?
They were part of it. They had 100,000 men under arms. Of course they should have been part of it. Instead, they were kept aside because Americans worried about the Turks.
So there's your first assessment of where the U.S. went wrong in its policy. To take us on down the U.S. line, then we'll turn to the Iraqi line.
You see, the issue goes back to something we were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. I wanted Iraqis to participate in their own liberation. That is what I didn't want, was a perfectly streamlined American engineering operation.
Superpower, hyperpower,
just
rollover.
Just removed the regime, and then people watched, said, thank you very much. Now the Americans run them, administer their affairs, down to even writing their traffic ordinance rules and so on. This was utterly ridiculous. I was never for that. None of us were. Frank, and that's, by the way, totally documented in the records of the Iraqi
opposition. But is it realistic? We're talking about realism here. Were Iraqi exiles and dissidents who'd been so crushed really in a position to come in and make that happen? Clearly, Washington, I guess, judged they weren't.
That was the judgment of certain sections in Washington. Remember, this is very important. This country did not go into this war as one voice. It went in as several extremely divergent voices, furious with one another. There was greater tension in Washington. There was more bitterness between American officials, State Department, Pentagon, White House, CIA, than I ever saw in my life. I was reeling with the shock of it. And these people continued their little turf battles over, which were very important battles, by the way. They were over basic questions of philosophy, the State Department, for instance, versus the Pentagon. They were fundamental. They were all, by the way, 9/11 questions, nothing to do with liberating a country necessarily from 30 years of dictatorship. That was my agenda principally. But they were turf wars over how to go about doing this, there were forces that were utterly against the involvement of Iraqis and that argued for an occupation. It was supposed to be many, many years long, by the way. They changed that. I mean, the United States changed along the way. And incidentally, one other very important question. American mistakes are very many and considerable, from the manning, the number of troops involved, from the lack of planning, et cetera, et cetera. We've all seen them. They've been written about, and I basically agree with all of them. Iraqi mistakes have not been written about anyway nearly enough.
But you're talking about the turf battles in Washington. What about the turf battles of your people, country?
They were enormous. They were enormous. They are enormous, of course. But they began very, very short. They were going on in the opposition. That's natural.
Didn't you anticipate them?
Turf battles, I mean, battles over
sectarian
ideas.
Civil war is...
That was definitely a danger and a threat. There were discussions inside the opposition about that, but there was no indication that leaders who behaved the way they have done post-2003 were going to behave that way pre-2003. At least that, as an active participant in all of that, I mean, the dangers could be seen, but I would not have predicted that secular men, secular individuals and parties and so on and so forth would so completely decide to abandon and jettison the idea of Iraq and go for a sectarian
view. Why not? Why couldn't
you
anticipate that? It seems such an overwhelming fact of life now. Why couldn't that be seen beforehand? Or could it? Did you not want to see it?
No. Look, if you look at my books, you will see that the dangers of sectarianism are written out and are pointed out. The nature of a totalitarian government is to actually inculcate sectarianism. It as it attacks Kurds as Kurds and Shiites as Shiites, it increases the tendency of Kurds and Shiites to think of themselves, their Shiism, as first, and they defend their Shiism.
So it's Saddam's fault.
So if you attack a man for being a Shiite, he will respond by asserting he is the very thing he was attacked for being even more forcefully than before. Mm-hmm. So Saddam, after 1991, began a very active sectarian campaign. No more Shiites after the day was written on the tanks that went rolling into Najaf as he crushed the uprising after the last Gulf War. Mm-hmm. So a series of articles and press and so on and so forth appeared afterwards. Now, the issue was whether that's a real danger, a real tendency. The nature of politics is that you work with those dangers. They're not written they're not written in stone, so to speak. They are dangers, and therefore you can avert them as well as fall into their trap. And people like myself chose to fight them and try to avert them as much as possible.
You failed.
I still think that was the right thing to do.
You failed. Why?
Of course. Why? Any endeavor you take in life, you sometimes succeed and you sometimes fail.
That doesn't sound quite good enough.
A certified ironclad guarantee that if I enter into a political project, I know what the result is going to be? No, I didn't. How could anybody do that? How can you enter into an election knowing for absolutely sure your candidate won? Then after the election, your candidate doesn't win. Somebody tells you, how on earth did you get involved in that candidate, supporting that candidate when he didn't win? You wasted your time. No, presumably you believed in a thing or two about this world, and that's the reason why you pushed for a particular candidate versus another.
That's hard for American ears to take on board at this point. You can appreciate that because the cost of this, not only to Americans but to Iraqis, has been so high. But set that aside, though it's a lot to set aside. Why do you think it tilted this way towards sectarian conflict instead of what you prayed for, what you hoped would be a more, kind of hand-holding, united country going forward?
I didn't envision that. Absolutely no idea where you get these funny expressions from. You think I thought it was some pretty little picture?
I don't mean pretty little, but I mean at least hanging together instead of dying apart like it's going on now. That was your presumption, that the country would, sectarian groups would hang together.
That it was possible, that there was a historic opportunity here to turn this into a positive and a good thing. By the way, I think for Iraqis in the very long run, it will still turn out to be a good thing. Unfortunately, and this is where I come in, this is where the mistakes come in, this is where my own self-assessment comes in, I think bodies, all those bodies that will accumulate in the years to come, 10 years to come, before this finally sorts itself out, are just too heavy a price to pay. And I want to point the finger, that's my job as an intellectual, at those Iraqis above all, responsible in the current government, in the current new political class that was created post-2003 for those bodies.
And why did it happen that way? Why did it tilt towards sectarian strife instead of hanging together somehow, hard as that may have been?
And in large part, I believe, that is because, take for instance, the initial core of the new Iraqi political class and the 25 members of the governing council that Paul Bremer set up. Right from the outstart, particularly the Shiite grouping inside the 25 members, which was 13 out of the 25, behaved in a sectarian way. Shiites, now this is an important thing, and this, by the way, they were largely secular Shiites, but they chose, as Milosevic had done before them in former Yugoslavia, they switched their secularism and became and worked on a sectarian basis. That, I think, was a very important starting point for the deterioration in the political landscape.
Why did they do it? With everything that would mean, they must have, if not known, very strongly suspected what that would mean.
They did it perhaps calculating on crass political advantage. They did it also because they were operating out of a sense of victimhood. A politics of victimhood had emerged in which they thought politics was about getting the most for their particular group at the expense of everybody else. Now, the great big beneficiaries of this war would eventually be the majority of Iraqis who happen to be Shiite. But you can look at it as you can still continue, even though you are a majority, to think of yourself as a minority and scramble for getting the most, more and more and more of the pie, forgetting that you're going to lose a whole country in the process. In the process. Mm. Exactly. And that's exactly the kind of small scale, sectarian, narrow thinking that I think is represented by identity politics in general, be it in this country or in Iraq, no different. And was the beginning of the mass spread of sectarian politics.
We're talking with Kanan Makiya. He wanted Saddam out, and ultimately for the U.S. to do it. Now we are where we are. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's begin to turn to our listeners. Many want to join this. Martin is calling from Williamsburg, Virginia. Martin, you're on the air with Kanan Makiya.
Hello, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call. I appreciate being able to speak here. There's a lot of sophistry here. Retrospective judgment, we can always find something that could have been done better. All we can ask of our leaders is the best of intentions and good moral values. There's no guarantee of any human action. And I appreciate your expert today for pointing this out so strongly. Now, I'd like to cut to the chase and talk about the big question is what went wrong. The simple thing that went wrong demonstrates the conflict between idealism and realism. If we had taken that Iraqi army the day that Saddam's statue fell, and said, tomorrow you guys get your paycheck from us. You're our employees tomorrow. Instead, we sent them home with no means to support their family. We undercut their dignity. The same thing happened in World War One, when we didn't give the Germans a place at the table. And the bitterness and resentment, which is an inseparable part of human nature at being abused or oppressed, took over. It makes resentment, it makes revenge, it brings out all the evil in human nature. And all we had to do was say, you guys are working for us. They'd already demonstrated that they'd do anything for a paycheck. They were working for Saddam, and we're trying to do that belatedly.
Martin, you put a lot on the table, and let us pick it up. Kanan Makiya, you were on the opposite side of exactly that question.
But Martin is absolutely right. And therein lies a genuine area in which I was mistaken. Martin is right. The issue of the army and the way the army was handled was wrong. Now, let me go back a second.
You wanted it disbanded.
I didn't want it. I wanted
you wanted
it,
the Baathists
Excuse me. I'm on record as saying that the army ought to be changed into a giant big public relations force. And I never wanted their paychecks not to be paid. I'm not trying to defend myself because basically I approached the army with enormous mistrust.
The army should be dismantled and essentially rebuilt. Your words.
Yes, but in the documents that were voted on the Iraqi opposition, we called for those people to continue having their paychecks paid and to turn into a giant labor force that would help build the roads and bridges and so on and so forth of the country. That's on record in a document that was voted on at the Congress of the Iraqi opposition that met in London in December 2002. But basically, I approached the army, Martin is right, with enormous mistrust and suspicion. I looked at it. I remembered Iraqi history. And in Iraqi history, the army has waltzed in and out of politics, has been essentially the driving force of dictatorship in Iraq. And it has waged an eight-year-long war. It was the army that killed 180,000 or so Kurds during the 1980s. And like very many Iraqis, I no longer trusted this institution. I approached it extremely warily. And perhaps that mistrust percolated through into the kind of decisions that were finally taken. But to... And so in that sense, what Martin is proposing is absolutely right. And I think the method he suggests for having just simply switched, that is the new, if occupation was going to be the order of the day, then the occupying power should have immediately started paying that army its salary and using that army to a new ends and slowly, over time, restructuring.
It's just 5 years late. Let me ask you one other thing. He said all we can ask.
5 years late is not the point. The army was dismantled in 2003.
Well, it may be the point. A lot of people have died in that period, Iraqi and American, if it hadn't been dismantled. He asked something else. I want to come back after the break. He says, all we can ask is good values and the best of intentions in those, in this case, who take us to war. I want to know how you judge those when we return. Kanan Makiya is with us. We're talking about all that's gone on. since he and others pushed for the ouster of Saddam Hussein. We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with high-profile Iraqi scholar and advocate of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, Kanan Makiyeh, about how he looks now at his early passion for this war, about what he's learned from what's gone wrong in Iraq. He's author of Republic of Fear, all the way back in 1989, which began to reveal to the world the horror of the Saddam Hussein regime and years. Author of Cruelty and Silence, War, Tyranny, Uprising in the Arab World, and most recently The Monument, Art and Vulgarity in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. You can join the conversation. What have you learned from this invasion and its aftermath? What should Kanan Makiyeh learn? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And I don't ask that lightly, and certainly not cheekily. He had a lot of skin and moral passion in this game, and we all see it. 3 days after the start of the invasion, Kanan Makiyeh was on NPR's All Things Considered discussing America's next goals in rebuilding Iraqi society after the overthrow of Saddam, debathification, and dismantling the Iraqi army at the top of his list.
The United States is committing itself to totally dismantling the security services of the regime, everything except the traffic police, including the Republican Guard. We're having discussions about the army and what might happen to the army. I think the army itself should be dismantled and essentially rebuilt. The weapons of mass destruction, of course, is an all-American concern. But finally, there's this all-important new word that's entering the vocabulary, debathification.
Kanan Makiyeh, 3 days after the invasion in 2003, we have a lot of listeners. I'm going to turn to them, but let me just ask you first, going back to what Martin said, all we can ask of those in power when we set off, you know, to do what must be done, in this case war, is good values and the best of intentions. Do you believe the United States, the Bush administration, brought those to the prosecution of this war?
By the way, he added the word no guarantees, which is
yes,
important.
Yes, yes.
Good values but have no guarantees. So the question was
Do you believe the Bush administration brought good values and the best of intentions to this invasion of Iraq, this war?
You really should ask people in the Bush administration. I can tell you what my intentions were and the United States' position on that. I'm happy to whether they were good intentions or not. The weapons of mass destruction argument, for instance, was I really thought this was about the way I was rethinking my position, not about rehashing the issue of weapons of mass destruction was never the way I made the case for war. It is the way the Bush administration chose to make the case for war. That is the way the people who spin these things in the White House decided to do it, and I think that was the wrong way to do it. The way they should have done it was on the basis of the nature of the regime. Even the connection with al-Qaeda was not a strong argument, was not a strong case. I certainly believed, as did most other people in the world, as did the French intelligence agency, the German intelligence agency, that he had weapons of mass destruction. And I certainly believed that it was possible that there was a connection with al-Qaeda. But that was not, for me, the main argument for why the United States should go about this war. You did not sit on a high moral ground of politics by making that argument. And the Bush administration erred in making that the central plank of its policy. But it was not the only plank. As you know, they threw everything into the pot, as often happens in these cases. The democracy came very late in the order of the day. It came at the end of the summer of 2002. And I only was willing to work and talk to the State Department as part of the various working groups that they set up after they said that the democratization of Iraq was going to be a goal of U.S. policy. So now, what was their real policy?
The values, the intentions.
That's for the historians to judge and so on and so forth. I'm, as a political activist, and remember, about new beginnings, I was willing to say, okay, they have now committed themselves on paper to a democratization. They are now increasingly talking about the nature of this regime and getting rid of the terrible and awful things it did to this part of the world. This, I thought, was a good thing. And this, I thought, was something that we should run with, and I supported. Therefore, I was willing to enter those State Department working groups and work on the future of Iraq.
Take us then exactly to that, to the heart of your rethinking now, Kanan Makiyeh. What is the heart of it? Where has it brought you?
I was wrong, as Martin's pointed out, on the army and on the last issue that you brought up from that quote, the issue of debathification. Take the issue. This is a very important question. If you recall the quote you just had from NPR.
3 days after the invasion.
Yes. Debathification, in my mind, would resemble something like denazification post-World War II in Germany. Now, I wrote about this, it should be a process that resembled South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I wrote about that extensively. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In other words, de-Baathification was making sure that the ideology of Baathism, incorporated in the form of individuals of very prominent rank in the pre-2003 regime, should not be allowed to be the dominating ideology of the post-2003 regime. So people should be kept out of public office who were above a certain rank in the Ba'ath Party. That was what the Ba'athification meant. But it was linked with reconciliation, the other arm of truth-telling. Mm-hmm. There is truth-telling and there is reconciliation. That was the nature of the genius of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. In Iraq, our politicians went for the truth-telling, so to speak, or even that they didn't do. They just labeled people.
Yeah.
But I set up an NGO whose business was truth-telling.
The Iraq Memory Foundation.
But there was no politician, there was no Desmond Tutu, there was no Nelson Mandela, to drive the reconciliation, the forgiveness part.
So when you're rethinking, have you revisited? I mean, did you misunderstand your own country, your own countrymen and women?
I had hoped for better politicians. I had put up my faith in the ability of exceptional men and women to appear who would rise above that. Some did. There are such exceptional people who arose in Iraqi politics, but none of them reached the positions of leadership that we talk about. Take such a person today. You mentioned his name earlier, Barham Saleh. Mm. He is an outstanding person, a man of moral integrity, who has truly risen above the factional and ethnic strife. He is a Kurd, but he thinks like an Iraqi. He is behaving like an Iraqi politician who thinks of the interests of the whole of Iraq, not the interests of his own sect. Unfortunately, we did not have more Barham Saleh in the lead, and especially among Shiites. You see, the future of Iraq was also always going to be decided by the elite that emerged amongst Shiite Iraqis. Mm. Kurds are a minority. Sunnis are a minority. Sunnis also are reeling from the fact of what happened to them. It's going to be very hard for them to come to terms with the new regime. The majority had to reach out. The majority had to have a bigness of heart that concretely translated into politics, into gestures, into various, pulling them into government in disproportionate numbers and so on and so forth. This they did not have. They thought like victims. They thought about settling accounts. They thought about how can I get a better deal than them? How can I keep all the oil to myself and so on and so forth? That is the great historic mistake. I am of a Shiite background myself, and therefore the target of my self-criticism is over why such a leadership did not emerge amongst
Shiites. Ayad Alawi says this, that you're a romantic, he told Dexter Filkins in the Times, and that this was doomed. This was all doomed.
Excuse me, yes.
He said what was doomed was the attempt to refashion Iraq in a sort of civilizational makeover using American power in an alliance with a supposedly grateful Iraqi public.
If you notice, he also says that in light of all that's happened, he would now opt for order against liberation. I still, and this is where we're best of friends, I and Ali would disagree. I opt for liberation over order. Order meaning, in this case, the maintenance of the Saddam Hussein regime, which, by the way, is a very flimsy idea to start with, because Saddam Hussein's regime in pre-2003 Iraq was crumbling. This was a problem waiting to explode on the world agenda. 13 years of sanctions had brought Iraq to its knees, one war after another.
Perhaps we should have waited then.
Whatever we should have done, but my point is, this was a problem that was not going to go away by hiding our heads in the hand like ostriches.
Let's go to our listeners. Suzanne's calling from Buffalo, New York. Suzanne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Listen, I am so angry listening to this man. I want to know wasn't he over there leading a battalion? Why isn't he over there putting his neck out instead of sitting up in some high tower? Now he's sitting here backpedaling and splitting words and correcting his you know, what he said or what he didn't say. I find it so difficult to listen to this man. I'm so angry. Here's an Iraqi who isn't over there, you know, fighting the fight, willing to, you know, give advice to our government to send our people over there while he's sitting up in some ivory tower.
But Suzanne, do you give him credit?
With a shovel to shovel out your studio with all the BS.
I wonder, Suzanne, do you not give him credit for rallying the world against a brutal dictator?
Because we have many dictators. I do not think that any one person should be able to go to our government and say, hey, let's go take this guy out. We got people all over Africa. We've had a variety of dictators. We still have a variety of dictators who are just, you know, keeping so many people dominated and living in fear.
Okay, we got it. It's very clear. Kanan Makiya.
I suspect Suzanne would like to see me deported from this country, as among other things.
She didn't say that. She said she'd like to see you leading Iraqi troops.
I get
troops.
Lots of emails from people who think I should be deported instantly. This
but
is the great
it's important to say she did not see that.
This is the great moralistic, idealistic, mm-hmm. anti-war movement that carries its moral so lightly on its shoulder. Perhaps she also thinks that Saddam Hussein, she obviously thinks, should have remained in power, and she's perfectly comfortable to live with that kind of a situation. Therein lies a great big divide between Suzanne and myself. I can't accept to live in a world I do whatever the limited abilities that I am. I'm not a soldier. I don't know how to fight. I'm 60 years old and I have leukemia, so I'm not very perfect material to lead a battalion, as she knows. I mean, there's, you know, how people can speak such nonsense, it really amazes me.
Even after the losses that everyone's seen since the invasion, it amazes you?
The overwhelming losses are Iraqi losses. The overwhelming failure is Iraqi failure. That is where they're dying at the rate of 4 or 5, 10 to every American. That is where the real loss, that is where the real tragedy lies.
Norman is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Norman, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for accepting my call.
Sure.
The lady before me, Miss Susan, she just stole my thunder, but I mean, she had it dead on the head. I mean, if you stop and think about it, prior to our invasion of Iraq, we had Iraq in a box, and that was admitted by Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice and Donald Rumsfeld. Saddam Hussein was absolutely incapable of doing anything to us. Now we got this person who would not fight, who won't even go to his country to help his people.
He's been there.
Here sucking our blood, and now he has the audacity to get on this radio station and tell us that our administration made a mistake.
But Norman, let me ask you something. If it was your country that was under a dictator like Saddam Hussein, would you not reach out for help to topple that dictator if you didn't have the power yourself? Would you not have done that?
If you stop and think about it, the crimes that Saddam Hussein allegedly committed.
Now, let's take the allegedly off there. With respect, Kanan Makiya has documented these crimes. The mass graves are a fact.
The gentleman clearly thinks they're alleged.
No, but just as a point of fact. But anyway, Norman, yes, please.
Let me make my statement.
Yes, sir.
There has been a CIA intelligence briefing about the Kurds that have got gassed during the Iran-Iraq war. Iran admitted to that. We know that he didn't do it because...
Okay.
Perfect.
But I hate to get lost in that, Norman, but we get your larger point, and I thank you for it. Let me get a call from Cheshire, Connecticut. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think there is one more thing that we can expect from our leaders beyond good values and the best of intentions, and that is that they hold themselves and their subordinates accountable for the consequences of their actions. Our military holds each and every member accountable for the most seemingly insignificant transgressions, and that's because they understand what the risks are and what the consequences are, and what we haven't seen is accountability from our leaders.
Joe, may I ask you, how should accountability work then if you're not an American leader, but in a passionate Iraqi intellectual, an advocate of human rights, opponent of a dictator, when things go wrong? What should accountability mean for Kanan Makiya? Not that I'm saying we're in position to judge or throw stones, but we're thinking this through with a passionate thinker who made a stand. What should accountability mean for him now?
Accountability for him should mean coming out and speaking about what's gone wrong there and what we need to do in order to go right there.
So that's what he's...
I absolutely agree. And I'm trying to do that. I may not be doing it well. I'm trying to write about it. I'm working on a book exactly about that, holding myself, my countrymen above all, the political class that I supported post-2003 that has benefited from all of this, holding them, all of these different people, starting with myself, accountable for the various things that went wrong. I may not be doing it well. The book's not out, but I am trying to do exactly what you said.
What have you learned about human nature in these years?
That it is much, much more frail than we all like to give it credit for, and that we ought to factor in the frailty of our nature as human beings. Take more into politics. How you do that is a very difficult thing. That is our capacity to err, to do the wrong thing, to say the wrong thing, like one of your speakers before, to even begin to question basic verities. Iraqis did the same thing. They once again started to question very basic things, question the intentions of the United States in going in there, for instance.
Were they wrong to question that?
In the way...
That's human frailty?
Conspiracy-making and conspiracy theory in the Middle East is a name of the game for 30 years. So what we're talking about here is, you know, they start to say, what I'm talking about is that a small number of Iraqis will tell you point blank that the United States intended the chaos that has come about. They're unable to look at, well, that's real. It's human nature again. You know, their only explanation for why things have gone so wrong is actually the bad intentions of the United States. So it's something you have to struggle against. So this frailty of our natures, all of us, Americans and Iraqis, and Europeans who just sat by there and watched all of this and then were so happy and cheering that everything went wrong. That, for me, too, is a failing of human nature.
But given that frailty, and we've got half a minute, would it not make you a little less quick to go in, knowing the stuff humans are made of? Would you go in anyway? Would you do it again?
Remember, I'm tearing down the walls of a concentration camp. I would do it again. Knowing that those people who are coming out of there have informed on one another, have probably told on one another, have maybe even killed and policed each other, etc. Knowing all of that, and then God knows what those kinds of people who are filled with those kinds of sense of guilt will do when they try to build a society together. Yes, I would still do it.
There's the journey of Kanan Makiya. Kanan Makiya, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom. Oh, we're finished, right?
We're finished. But maybe we'll do it again. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.